Sri Gupta, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm this evening I'm continuing a conversation, well, a talk really, about freedom, which I started last week. So actually thinking that the topic of freedom we could have for many, many weeks. There's so many different aspects and dimensions of freedom. So this evening I'm really going to just touch on a couple of further themes tonight. But I'd encourage you to keep thinking about freedom in all its different ways, because it is a very rich topic. So last week I had an imaginary dinner party, and that was because I was asked for the LBC magazine if I could invite anyone for dinner, you know, alive or not, you know, who would I invite? And I immediately knew, you know, who I wanted to invite. And I was thinking dinner parties are nice things to have, so I think I'd like to have another dinner party. But actually, when I really thought about it, I thought it wasn't quite the right setting for today's honoured guest. I have one or two guests this evening, but I have one main honoured guest. So I thought, yeah, it's not quite the right setting. So I think we're going to go on just a bit of a journey through different locations and times even this evening, and really see where we end up. But at my dinner party last week, I had Martin Luther King, I had Dr. Ambedkar, and I had John Coltrane. So John Coltrane, the jazz musician, Dr. Ambedkar, who was a reformer in India, really helped ban untouchability, but also led his followers to to self-emancipation through leaving the Hindu religion and becoming Buddhist. It was a Hindu religion that sort of captured them in this caste system, and so he sort of converted to Buddhism, and through that all his followers did as well, and actually as a result sort of helped revive Buddhism in India as it had died out. So that's why he was there. Martin Luther King, I think you probably all know Martin Luther King. He was the great civil rights freedom fighter, whatever you call him, what do you call him? Just inspirational being, really, who really helped America move on from the sort of injustices of the day. So I had those three people. I had a couple of other guests who popped in, and that was Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize winning writer. And then I had also Rosa Parks, who just came and said hello. So those are my guests last week. And the three main guests really had a lot in common. They never met, but I felt they had a lot in common, and I felt they had a lot to teach us or remind us, really, as Buddhists. So these are things I thought they had in common. Well, firstly, they all managed to overcome very tough, very difficult circumstances that they were born into. And actually circumstances they were born into where there was also objective obstacles in their way. You know, in a way the society was not set up for them to succeed. It was sort of putting obstacles in their way. So they all, three of them, managed to overcome that. The other thing they have in common was that through what they were able to achieve, they inspired and gave courage to other people to follow in their footsteps. They showed it was possible to overcome all kinds of different circumstances and situations, and they did inspire many, many other people to follow in their footsteps. Thirdly, they realised that their own individual freedoms, which they had attained in many ways, they were successful. They could have had very much more comfortable lives for themselves, but they realised that wasn't enough. They realised that winning their own individual freedom was not enough. That they in fact, the more free they became, the more they felt responsible for others, to help them sort of achieve in a way what they had, or at least seen what they had about what was possible. So they encouraged, inspired, and gave courage to other people as well. So this, for them, freedom and responsibility you know, sort of went hand in hand. In a way, for them, you couldn't have one without the other. The more free they became, the more able they became, the more confident and influential they became, the more they felt able to respond to the situation in a much wider way. So I think that was quite interesting, and I sort of can pause here slightly, because I thought that's quite different to how we normally think of freedom in sort of popular way, in a popular culture. I think we tend to think of freedom as if I basically want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and that means that equals freedom. And that, in a way, I was thinking about this. I was thinking, well, there's a positive aspect of that in a sense, because, you know, we do have freedom of choice in this culture, in this country. We live in a democracy. We have a stable economy, and many of our sort of basic sort of rights have been sort of hard won through the years. And, you know, we have a right to education. We have a right to health. We can more or less live roughly where we want. We can marry who we want. You know, there's a lot of basic freedoms that we have, sort of human rights that we have in a culture like this, that we are very important, and that gives us choice. And we sort of want to protect that in many ways. However, the sort of popular view that goes alongside that, so that's all great, but there's another view that sort of mixes in with all of that, which is the more choice you have about everything, the freer you'll feel, yes? And the freer you feel, the happier you'll be. And that's actually where happiness lies. And so I think it's really interesting to just stop, pause there and think, is that true? Is it true that the more choices we have beyond our sort of basic needs and sort of basic human rights, beyond that, does it mean that we are freer? Does it mean that we are happier? I remember going to this, when my first trip to the States many years ago, it's all going to show my ages, but they had this huge, we didn't have huge supermarkets at one point in this country. We had sort of smaller sort of supermarkets. And I went to the States and saw this gigantic, you know, I don't know what it was, just like this warehouse, but it was a supermarket. And I went down one aisle, and the whole aisle was full of cereals, box cereals, of every colour, you know, blue, pink, green, and I just stood there, and I remember just standing there with my mouth open, because I just thought, well, I just didn't know where to turn, you know, sort of, you know, which one do you choose? You know, it would have taken ages, actually, just to walk down the whole aisle to decide which box of cereal you wanted to have. And I don't think I bought anything that day, because I didn't want to walk down and look at every cereal there was. And I think we had that kind of experience with TV. I remember, again, show my age, the time when there were just three TV channels. Anyone else remember that? There was BBC One, BBC Two, and ITV. And then Channel 4 came, which was mega exciting. Then there was another one. What's the other one? Which obviously wasn't that exciting, because I can't remember Channel 5. Channel 5 came. So that was all great. I thought you didn't need any more. but then digital came. And then so many channels, and not only digital, we then have all the other Netflixes and various other things. But how many times have you sort of, you know, either been at your house or been at somebody's house and you say, let's put something on, and you just spend ages switching channel to channel to channel, and then the feeling you get when there's still nothing to watch is really, really just feels, it's not satisfactory, is it? It's not a satisfactory experience. So more choice by and of itself doesn't mean that we're going to feel freer, happier, more fulfilled. In fact, what more choice actually gives us is a real dilemma, because what it says to us is, well, what is influencing the choices I make? Yes. Am I making a free choice when I decide to choose this as opposed to this? You know, what is influencing that? Is it a free choice? Am I freely making a choice? Or am I influenced by things that I'm not even aware that I'm influenced by? So this is a really interesting thing, because I think we don't probably spend enough time evaluating how to make good choices. And it's only often when things go wrong that we look back and think, what influenced me making that choice? Yeah, why did I make that choice as opposed to this choice? And we can make choices that actually are definitely not in our interest, that definitely harm us. You know, individually, we know that, but also collectively. So Subhuti, the president, was here a couple of weeks, well, a week or so ago now, and he was saying that, you know, even in democracies, democracies have chosen leaders who have harmed them. And you could see the potential of that in what they were saying. And he quoted Hitler, he mentioned Hitler and Mussolini. They were voted in, you know, by the populace. So yes, how do we make choices that are in our interest, and not just in our interest, but in other people's interests as well? Because sometimes our choice that is in our interest, we don't look further down the line and recognise actually somebody else's freedom may be impacted by the choices that we make. Yes, and we see that with the environment and many other things. So more choice by and of itself doesn't necessarily lead to freedom. And we need to get better, I think, at sort of trying to understand, well, how do I make better choices that are good for me and others, beneficial for me and others. So I'm saying that just because my three honoured guests last week, they understood, they weren't thinking about, oh, well, I want more choice necessarily. They wanted human rights, equal rights. But they saw that their freedom included responsibility to others, and the two goes hand in hand. So the other thing they had in common was that they were highly impressive individuals, yet they knew, and that they had this real strong sense of responsibility, and they knew that they had to keep working on their own mental and emotional state in order to be able to help the people that were following them. They all suffered at different times through fear, disillusionment, doubt, anger. You know, they were human. They were human as well. But they recognised that other people were looking to them for freedom. So they had to keep working on their own mental states, keep trying to be positive, you know, stand in the face of a lot of challenges and keep going. And so it's quite interesting that in a way the responsibility they had for others, we can feel like responsibility is a bit of a burden, can't we? You know, it's a bit like, oh, it's much easier just to think about myself, yeah? But for them, the more responsibility they had, the more they cared about their followers, the more that in sort of encouraged them to keep working on themselves, keep finding freedom within themselves, which obviously helped them with their followers, but obviously helped them too. So it was this paradox of the more free I am, the more responsibility I feel towards others, the more free I have to be. Yeah. So it was kind of this very sort of a positive loop, if you like, that they were in. And then because they felt the responsibility to others, and because they knew they needed to keep working on their own, you know, mental, emotional state, they were committed. They had to have some kind of level of discipline in their life, and they were committed. And they all had sort of higher ideals that they sort of were drawn to that helped them. They didn't rely just on themselves, yeah? They knew that what they were up against was huge, so they had to look outside of themselves as well for inspiration and for support. So Dr. Ambedkar, as I said, he became a Buddhist and he practiced the teachings, he encouraged his followers to do so. Martin Luther King, he was inspired by the Christian faith and he spoke unapologetically about love and the importance of love. And Coltrane, he had his creative, muses, really, that sort of inspired him. And they all actually sort of explored Indian philosophy as well. So they also had that in common. It's quite interesting. So those were my guests last week, they've all been in my mind for a very long time, I still sort of draw inspiration from them in different ways. They all arrived at the fact that spiritual freedom is where real freedom comes from. Because they were working at on their hearts and their minds, and because they were influencing, trying to transform the hearts and minds of others, they all recognise that, well, that's spiritual freedom. If your heart and mind is transformed, it gives you spiritual freedom. Not freedom of choice, necessarily, but spiritual freedom. And they all arrived at that understanding. So I was looking for a good quote from one of them to sort of capsulate all of that, but I found it from this person who I won't say who it is. I think you'll probably guess who this person is. It's one of our guests for this evening. So they say, it was during those long and lonely years that my hunger for the freedom of my own people became a hunger for the freedom of all people, white and black. I knew as well as I knew anything that the oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed. A man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. He is locked behind the bars of prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I am not truly free if I am taking away someone else's freedom, just as surely as I am not free when my freedom is taken from me. The oppressed and the oppressor alike are robbed of their humanity. Can we guess who that is? Yeah. So that's Nelson Mandela. And just this sense of, you know, that they were working, they understood that the transformation lay in spiritual freedom in the hearts and minds of men and women and all people. And for them, that was them, that was their own hearts and mind, that was their followers, that was people that weren't following, that was their enemies, if you like, those who were actively against them. It included everyone, because in order to live in a world that is harmonious, that's loving, that's enabling us to all fulfil our potential, then we all must be working for freedom in some way. We must be working for our own and others, whoever they are. And they really understand that, and that is spiritual freedom. And in this article, it says about Mandela, it says, after years of imprisonment, physical and emotional abuse, and separation from his family, Mandela said, I realised they could take everything from me except my mind and my heart. They could not take those things. Those things I still had control over. And I decided not to give them away. And then this author goes on to say, so Mandela's story is really the story of those two things he never gave away. His brilliant mind and his great heart. That's very encouraging, isn't it? And inspiring. You know, that actually, and also it's very, salutary as well. That in a way that the only things we really have are our mind and our heart. Everything else can be taken away, can be lost. Except our mind and our heart. So yes, I was thinking, well, that sort of means that all oppression in every form has its origins in the mind. So I thought, let's pause and take that in. All oppression has its origins in the mind. Certainly that was what Ambedkar believed. He became disillusioned with politics, as I mentioned last week. And he believed that, and that's certainly the Buddhist view, that all difficulties and problems, certainly that we face, come from the mind. But is that true? I thought it's important to ask ourselves the question, is that true? Does that match our experience and the evidence that's before us? So I kind of thought we could just have a scan through the papers today see what's going on and see if we think that those things are created by the mind. So what's going on at the moment? There's the Russian spy saga, yeah? And the diplomatic fallout from that. You can, let's see what else is there. What else is going on currently?
Brexit.
There's referendums. There's the one here, we had the Brexit referendum, but also the one in Spain. And there were a lot of difficulties there, still going on. What other things are going on? Syria, yeah, so count number of wars through the world. Syria's in our newspapers most days. Yemen as well is one that doesn't hit the news as often, but is also terrible. Any other things that are going on?
Yarmouth.
Sorry?
Yarmouth.
What's that?
So there are women there who are on hunger strike.
Oh. Okay, yeah, so many people stuck in detention centres, seems to be an escalation of the number of deportations that are happening, yeah, what else?
Congress elections in the US.
The?
Congress elections in the US.
Elections in the US, mm-hmm. And contentious and difficult, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Well.
Yeah.
So you have all of these young teenagers from different parts of the country, all different backgrounds, coming together and saying, "Right, we're not going to do this." I think tomorrow is the big march from Washington D.C. and other famous areas because they're just sick and tired of it.
Yeah, yeah. So the gun violence we're kind of used to, but what's different is this: the response that's happening. It's coming from young people. And it's also coming from business as well. Businesses are beginning to go, you know what, we're not sure we want to align ourselves with this in the way that they have in the past. So that's interesting as well. So, I mean, that's just a snapshot. There's lots and lots of other issues going on. Mm-hmm. Are they made by the mind? Anyone think no? Yeah, okay, you go. Okay, so they are real. So these are real things that are suffering, that are causing suffering in many different ways to people. And what are the origins of those issues? The origins of those issues and what perpetuates those issues? So that's what I'm interested in. What are the origins? How are they created, if you like? And what's perpetuating them? Yeah.
Okay, so for example, with the gun laws, mm-hmm. Constitution, in those days,
yeah.
It was a different time. So yeah. It was, you know, you can bear arms, but obviously times have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
And America has changed. But the view has always been, you know, I have that right.
Yeah.
So for me, it's created out of an idea, but from a time where values and so forth, the political structure was different. It was just developing. America's a new country.
Yeah.
So now it's almost like a war zone in
a
sense.
Yeah. So what you said there were ideas behind the way the Constitution was written. There were views and there were values, yes? So those views and values and ideas and ideology, they come from the mind, yeah? They're not external somewhere. They come from the mind, yeah? And then what perpetuates these things, if you look at war, it's revenge, it's self-interest, it's ignorance, it's fear. If you look at any of those issues, you can ask yourself, what's the mind states that are either creating or perpetuating those things? Now, to dismantle those things are quite complicated. There needs a lot of different things to change those situations. Yeah. So structures and systems and all of those things are needed often to help change those once they've created and once they've got a life of their own. But mind is also involved in that, yes? If President Assad, for example, in Syria, decided to do something, to be different, do something different, we would have a probably different outcome going on there. So in a way, mind is involved, yes? And mind matters. Mind is hugely significant in what's going on in the world. And we know that from our own personal lives, so that's the world out there, but we also do create our own worlds, yes? You know, the way our life has changed over time. Your life is not the same as it was, you know, 10 years ago. And that's obviously through time and age and all the rest of it, but it's also perception, yes? Your perception, maybe your values, views have changed, and therefore your life has changed. So it's a very interesting thing. Mind matters. Mind is hugely significant. In fact, Buddhism would say mind creates our personal world and the world we're in. So yeah, do that exercise from time to time and look at what's the mental states going on here, particularly if it's things that are going on in the world, because we can often think they're just out there, but actually everyone's involved in this creating the world we're in. So anyway, I came to a very sort of unsophisticated version of that when I was young. I sort of came to a view that I want to make a difference in the world. That was very important to me, that I felt I could make a difference in the world. I saw the difficulties going on around me. At the same time, I wanted to be happy too. So I sort of thought, well, I want to be happy. I wanted personal fulfillment and happiness, and I wanted to make some kind of positive contribution to the world I was in. And so sometimes I felt like, right, okay, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, I don't know, march for this or campaign for that or raise money for this or argue about this. But then I'd think, oh, well, I've got so many issues myself. So I've, you know, I've got lack of confidence and I get annoyed at things and I get into conflict and, you know, and now I think, well, how do you make a difference in the world and be personally fulfilled and happy? I want to wake up in the morning and be happy with the day and feel fulfilled and know I was doing good things, and then go to bed really, you know, like that was a great day, you know. And that's kind of how I wanted to live, and it didn't always go like that, you know. There were things that would happen in the middle of the day that I couldn't control, it seemed, and didn't go my way, and I didn't know how to change, and it was all very frustrating at times. So I felt those two things would diverge, you know, those aspirations, how to live a positive, fulfilling life personally, how to have my world, I guess, harmonious, and then how to make a contribution to the world. And I didn't know how to do it. Where do you start with that sort of ambition or aim? So it wasn't clear to me until I had a very significant plane journey. So I'd been in the Philippines, and I'd had a very interesting, challenging, difficult trip there in many ways. And I was very glad to be getting back to home. And I remember thinking, right, I'm going to change my life when I get back home. And on this plane, it was long flights, it was 18 hours. And at a certain point, it hit turbulence. And at first you thought, oh yes, really, I'm not very comfortable. Everyone was just, you know, staying with it. But then the turbulence got worse and worse. And then we were like dropping, it felt like hundreds of feet. The plane would just lunge, you know. And then at that point, the air hostesses and staff on board started shouting at us to get our seatbelts on. And they basically began to rise in this plane, this sort of panic. It started very slowly, and then it became full-blown panic. There were lots of Filipinos on board, and Philippines is a very Catholic country. So when this panic began to rise, there were lots of rosaries. I just saw all these rosaries come out. And people started praying, and you know, you saw the sweat forming on people's faces, and the air hostesses looked really angry and annoyed with us, and they were marching up and down, and I just got terrified with all of this. It's like I felt, well, I'm young here, and no one's, you know, I need someone to help me deal with this. But they were all focused on their own fear, and I remember my sort of the armrest, gripping the armrest of my seat, and I wasn't the only one. Many of us were doing that, and I didn't have anything I could turn to. I sort of had let go of Christianity, and I thought, well, I don't have rosaries, and if I prayed for God, I wouldn't sort of believe it somehow right now. I wish maybe I hadn't given it up, but I have. There I was, nothing to turn to. And I just thought, I could die now. I could really die now. This could be it. And then what would my life been about? And I didn't, there were no answers that came to me. And so that made me feel really sad. I felt terrified and sad at the same time. And at that point, I then turned and looked out of the window of the plane. And what saw me, what the sight I saw completely held me in its sway for, felt like, for a long time. And what I saw was this incredible, beautiful sky. So there was it was this expanse of sky and these colours. And I remember there was orange and reds and purples and just, you know, there's a range of colours. And then there was this expanse of black, and there was this huge star right in the middle of this sort of black. And it felt almost mystical, this scene. I'd never seen anything like it. And I just gazed at this sky for what felt like, well, for a very long time. And I just was touched. The beauty of it really touched me very deeply. And at some point I turned back to the plane, and it was the scene was still going on, you know, rosaries, people getting anxious, people sweating. But I felt completely different. I felt my body was suddenly relaxed. I felt a sense of concern for others, which was completely the opposite of what I was feeling before. Like, hey, I'm young, look after me. It suddenly was, I could see the anxiety, the fear on everyone's faces, their body language, and I felt a concern for them. I did want the plane to land, and I sort of recognised that. I thought, I want the plane to land because I want to live. I want to live. The scene I'd seen was so beautiful. I thought, the world is really, truly beautiful. I just hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen it that way. I really wanted to live. And I wanted to live a life that at the end of it, I could die without regrets. So there was this sense, I was very relaxed, I was very calm, I had a concern for others, and out of that that sort of feeling was a resolve. And the resolve was, I want to live so I can give, so I can love, and I know what that means, and so I can die without regrets. I knew at that point that the only thing I had was my mind. And I saw that my mind, well, just the change of consciousness that had happened. I was still in the same circumstances. The circumstances had not changed, but I had changed, and I had a radically different response. So I was very happy that the plane did land. Yes, I kept that resolve in my mind, and I had it could have waned, but then I had another incident which I shared last week that again brought me up short and brought me up against that, you know, life could be short, I may not have long. So I eventually found my way to a Buddhist center and learnt to meditate. Actually, my mind was all over the place in meditation. I remember my first experiences and thinking, I don't see how this is going to help me at all with anything, because I couldn't concentrate and I couldn't see the connection between mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana really and dying without regrets. I couldn't see the connection. And it was only when I went on retreat for the first time that I began to see the links. On this retreat, one of the team members, he said to me, there's this event happening. This is an event happening in London. Why don't you come to it? So I think I'd been in meditating for about 2 weeks at that point. And I thought, well, I wasn't in London at the time. So I thought, oh, yeah, my family in London. I can pop to see my family. I can pop into this event as well, you know, see what it's all about. So anyway, I came just to York Hall up the road. walked in this huge hall, and there were hundreds of people in this hall. He didn't tell me what the event was. He just said this Buddhist event. And there were hundreds of people in this hall. It was all decorated really colourfully. And the people were embracing each other and lots of laughter. And some people were having really serious conversations. But they just looked like a very purposeful atmosphere. So I walked in only knowing this particular person. And I sort of sat down, and actually on the shrine, I'd never seen a, it was a huge shrine, and on the shrine there was a huge picture of a Tibetan lama, a picture similar to what's on the shrine today, but much, much bigger. And they were celebrating his death. He died the year before, and they were celebrating his death. And through that, Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement, he was presiding over the event, and different people were getting up and talking about his life. And sort of person after person spoke about, you know, gave different anecdotes about him. And in between all of that, some people were prostrating full length to the picture, which I thought was super weird. I thought, this is really weird to prostrate. At the same time, I was also moved by it. It was a really, it's interesting how you can have two very different experiences at the same time. I was also moved by it because I thought they felt love actually towards this person, and they were free. They were freely expressing it. So I was moved by that as well. And towards the end, there was an announcement that said, "Oh, we're going to do a sevenfold puja now." So I turned to the one person I knew in the room and said, "What's a puja?" And he said, "Oh, you're really about to find out, you know." So then I was led in. It's hundreds of people reciting the sevenfold puja. All these words I'd never heard before. It sounded very strange. Again, very strange words. Lots of chanting. At the same time, I felt I was hearing the truth. I thought some of these words are giving me the truth. So I was very moved by the experience. I remember sitting there at the end. I stayed for the whole day, evening, and I was sitting there at the end, and I just really had to take it all in, like something had happened. And I know what had happened, because during the puja, I realised that I was a Buddhist. I realised I was a Buddhist, and I also knew that I'd be a Buddhist for the rest of my life. And I remember walking home that night, and it was dark, and it was raining, and it was cold. It was February, so it was really cold. And I remember walking home, and I had lots of buses and trains to catch to get to where I was staying. But I remember feeling like I was walking on air, and that was such a beautiful feeling. So, so the man on the shrine that night, and the man on the shrine today, and our sort of most revered, honoured guest is called Dado Rinpoche. And he was from Tibet, and he was an incarnate lama, which means that he was a reincarnation of a previous beloved teacher, beloved lama. And he was told from a young age, I think about the age of 8, he started his training actually at the age of 8, his Buddhist training, which apparently was very rigorous even at that young age. They would sort of take them off, these lamas, and house them in these monasteries and really give them a really, proper sort of dharmic education. But he was told that he was a bodhisattva. So I remember hearing that word for the first time at this event, a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva was someone who was striving for enlightenment, working towards enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And that was such a radical concept to me, that you could be working towards your own freedom for other beings. He had this very vigorous training. He became an abbot of one or two various monasteries, but he would spend his time, some time in India as well, and Nepal. And he was there when the invasions was happening, and I believe many Tibetan refugees. Anyway, he was there when to capture many of the Tibetan refugees when they poured in from Tibet. There were many, many orphans amongst them, traumatized, children. And he set up a school. That was what he did. He set up a school basically looked after these children. The school's still going, is it? It's still going. It's still going. Many people in Sri Ratna sort of helped fund that school and kept it going. But so he set up school, and he's his life was just amazing, because I mean, you know, he'd get up in the morning and meditate for 4 hours, practice for 4 hours, and then he would work in the school, you know, during the day, and then the evening he would meditate again. And obviously he would do all his teaching responsibilities as well. So Bhante Sangharakshita was one of his disciples. And then in the school they taught secular education, but they also taught Dharma and they taught arts and culture. He was a real... he really believed in the importance of culture and the arts to help people grow. So hearing his story, I was able to see how, yes, working through your own freedom. I mean, what I got from the story was that he was somebody who had managed to sort of enter a stream of ongoing positive emotion. Bhante Sangharakshita says he never saw him have any negative emotion whatsoever. So he managed, through all the decades, I have to say, of practice, he managed to have this experience of I don't know about infinite, but certainly an ongoing positive emotion that was continuous. And with that, there was a lot of creativity as well. So he didn't have an easy time necessarily. The school would often have struggled with funds just because they weren't able to claim government grants because they were teaching the Dharma as well. He would get into difficulties. Well, people would have difficulties with him because he wouldn't join in the politics. The Tibetan sort of hierarchies, he sort of eschewed that, and that they found that very sort of suspicious. He also treated people alike. So whether you were a high, you know, lama or scholar, or whether you're a homeless person, he would have the same regard, which was deep consideration. But again, so he wouldn't put people on sort of pedestals, and that was obviously sort of expected often. So again, you know, he wasn't always popular. He was also outspoken, apparently. Like if he thought something, you know, wasn't helpful, wasn't beneficial, he would say so. So yes, he had his people who, you know, sort of weren't in favour of him, but nonetheless, he was able to respond to that with a seemingly sort of ceaseless creativity. And that his story made me see what's possible. I just thought it is possible to be working towards your own freedom and through that benefit others. However you're doing that, you know, for him it was a school and all the Tibetan community that was there, and actually many Western disciples that then came to see him. So yes, so he gave me inspiration to just commit to working on my mind and heart. And I felt that I would be okay if I did that, as long as I kept the sort of idea and the ideal of a bodhisattva in mind, that you're doing that not just to make your own life better necessarily, that's important, but through that you can have this much wider impact. So, and Bhante Sangharakshita, I'll sort of quote him, because he says, Buddhism not only teaches us that our first duty is to understand things as they really are, but it gives us courage to make that attempt. It exhorts us never to allow ourselves to be overwhelmed by the flood of thoughts and emotions which come pouring in upon from all sides, but to weigh and test each one in the light of our knowledge and experience. The Buddha therefore taught us that if we want to see things as they really are, if we desire to act nobly and powerfully in the affairs of life, we must first learn to retire within ourselves and hear, or rather feel, the whisper vibrating through the silence there. So that retiring within ourselves, you know, I somehow felt like I needed permission to be able to really do that, to retire within myself, to meditate deeply, to reflect. I sort of felt like I did need permission to do that. And in a way, the idea of the Bodhisattva gave me real permission to do that, because I knew that the efforts I would make would have a broader, wider effect. But retiring to that stillness within. It sometimes takes courage, doesn't it, to even do that, particularly if you've had a hard day. I don't know about you, but if you've had a hard day, you sometimes say, well, actually, if I just sit, that would help, yes? But it can be hard to just sit, you know, if you've had a hard day. And I think sometimes, or if you've got a lot going on in your life, because sometimes we worry about what we're going to find, yes? Is that a common experience? We sort of worry what we're going to find. Sometimes we don't want to look too deeply in case we don't like what we find, yeah? But with reflection and the Dharma, I mean, if we do have the courage to sit, you know, when things are difficult, or when our lives are going through difficult patches, or sit at any moment, really, through doing so, if we're reflecting on the Dharma as well, we'll see that what's going on in our mind is dependent upon the conditions, yes? They've arisen because conditions have come into being that's produced those things. And that takes time to see that, and reflection to see that, but it also is an opportunity. That's a gateway to freedom, because we also see there that if those conditions have produced the difficulties, the challenges, whatever you're going through, then different set of conditions can produce a different outcome, yes? And that we are then free to create those different conditions. So Bhante says this very succinctly. He says, when you see your predicament clearly, when you know where you're starting from, you are in a position to perceive the choices before you, which gives you a certain degree of freedom. It isn't absolute freedom. You can't choose your starting point necessarily, but you are free to choose what you make of the situation. Where you are is less important than whether or not you know where you are. Yeah? So where you are is less important than knowing, you know, where you are. There is freedom which arises from knowing oneself and knowing the possibility of evolving beyond one's present condition. So the more we see our conditioned mind, the more we see the constraints that's sort of holding us in, but the more then we see the possibilities within that. If we can stay with that, with metta, and if we bring the teachings into mind as well. And I remember before I was ordained, an order member said to me, I can't remember what I was talking about, some difficult issue I was going through, and she said, there's so much more to you than you realise, you know. And that was like a massive revelation. I know it's a very simple thing, but at the time I thought, really? There's more to me than this and than what I think I am? And she really was very emphatic about that, and I just thought it was a massive relief, actually. I thought, great, I'm glad there's more to me than I think, because then, well, I can move towards that. I can move toward, even if I don't really know who I really am, even if I'm totally identified with my current sense of who I am, if I can have faith that there is more to me than my experience of myself, then I can continue to practice with that in mind. And I felt that was very reassuring and a relief and a revelation. So so yes, there's more to us than our current experience of ourselves. There's more to us than the way we identify our experience. There's more to us than our current set of conditions. There's more to mind than conditioning. There's beyond conditioning is an unconditioned experience. So the other thing I was thinking about, well, what does lie beyond that conditioned self? What is that? And what is the experience of becoming free? What does that actually feel like? How do we know we're becoming more free? So I think that's a really important question. And it's one that, well, in a way, an order member asked Dada Rinpoche that sometime ago. How do I know my practice is working, she said. And she said, or worse to the effect, are you becoming more kind? So I really, when I heard that, I really loved that answer. Because, well, in a way, It brings us back to our starting point, you know, knowing one's mind and knowing one's heart, so you can live fully, which means being able to love oneself and others and be in relationship to the world that is beneficial. And we get all kinds of experience. I think if you go into meditation, I mean, in a way, that experience I had in the plane was quite a important experience, because I saw through that consciousness is quite vast, and it's beautiful. So in a way, the conditions I was in was the plane. That was my current. That was the limits at that time. Yes. But there's sort of somehow that sky showed me there's more, so much more to that. So what I experienced was a sense of relaxation, spaciousness. That also gave me a sense of depth. It's almost like I felt myself from being very scattered, you know, suddenly I felt was very concentrated. And through that concentration, faith arose, and a resolve arose, and a commitment arose. And actually, if you enter higher states of consciousness, in a way, that's often what happens. You go beyond your conditioned experience, and there's a relaxation, there's a sense of space, and then all kinds of things can happen there. It might be a sense of a coming together, a bringing of one's energies together, or you might experience a real sort of unfolding of energies. You know, you might suddenly have loads of energy. Creativity comes as well. You think new thoughts. Thoughts you hadn't realised was there suddenly come into being. So consciousness is vast, and going deeper, whether that's through meditation, reflection, even in communication and friendship, you can access different levels of consciousness, which helps one experience one's current situation quite differently, and then can change one's current situation. So consciousness and freedom. So where have we been? I think we've been all around lots of different places. Let's see, so we've been Philippines and Bethnal Green up the road. There was Tibet and Kathmandu. And we're finding ourselves back here. South Africa as well, with Nelson Mandela. And I sort of want to end with, Dada Rinpoche, really. He had this slogan which said, "Cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love." So the doctrine is the Dharma, whatever helps you become free, whatever helps you actually experience the truth. We want to respect and honour what gives us truth. Truth is hard won by. I don't know if every time you've had some revelation or insight about your experience, it's been hard won. It doesn't necessarily come easily. And so we want to honour whatever helps us get there, and that's honouring the Dharma. The living united, well, that is a recognition that we're all in the same boat. Wherever your starting point is, we're all in the same boat, because we all just have essentially our minds and hearts. You know, no matter what job you do, no matter, you know, whatever's going on in your life, the fact is we all have that. We come into the world with that, and that's the last thing we'll be aware of when we breathe our last breaths. It will be what's going on, you know, with our experience. Yeah. So we all have that. We're all in the same boat. So that living united is just being able to stand alongside others in that. And the more we sort of recognise what we have in common, the less separate we feel, and the more, like our great sort of other guests, the more we'll want to naturally respond, you know, to others, to other people and their situation. It's like others' pain we will experience, and others' joys we experience. And radiating love. So I was thinking, if I had to have two words at the moment, it might change, but you might ask me another time, I might find two different words. But at the moment, if you ask me two words that define freedom, I might say, I would say radiance and love. Those are the two words that I think for me right now expresses what freedom might feel like. So radiance, I was thinking about radiance. Radiance, there's this still point. There's this still point where there's a still sort of relaxed point whereby things are then, something is then shared, yes, or emitted quite widely. So that still point is knowledge and understanding, sort of insight, if you like. And from that knowledge and understanding, then you can, it sort of, well, in a way, you see the mind. You see the mind for its brightness, for its energy, for its luminosity, and that is shared. So there's a real brightness. When there's understanding, it's like the light bulb moment, you know, it's kind of that writ large, that when there's real understanding, there's brightness, and that brightness is shared. So radiance is a word that I currently particularly enjoy. And then the other word is love, which we've talked a lot about already. But love as in, well, in fact, I'll read Bhante's last words. He says, the enlightenment experience is therefore not only of illumination and freedom, but also of infinite and inexhaustible love. A love which has for object all sentient beings and which manifests as uninterrupted activity in pursuit of their temporal and spiritual welfare. So it's this inexhaustible love. I can't actually imagine what inexhaustible love is, really, actually. But I'd like to imagine it. I think it's a good thing to imagine. And certainly, I imagine the Buddha had that. So we're going to end with a sense of, well, being in the presence. I think we can imagine being in the presence of this sort of energy that's radiating, this warmth, this care and concern, that gives us courage, that gives us courage and inspiration just to take the next step, whatever that next step is for us. So whatever that next step is for us, we don't have to worry. It's a bit like what you were saying, Silipia, in the meditation. We don't have to worry about the outcome if we take the next step, but we have that sort of vision of that warmth and sort of that radiance in our minds, then we are going to just find ourselves moving towards that. So I'll end there. So thank you very much.